BBC World Service. This is Helena Merriman with The Inquiry. This week...
THG, tetrahydrogesterone, insulin, fast-acting insulin, EPO, growth hormone, T3, the brand name Cytomel.
How easy is it to dope in sport? Last week, anti-doping agencies in Britain and the US began their investigations of top American coach Alberto Salazar. He's accused of giving performance-enhancing drugs to his athletes. He strenuously denied the allegations in a 12,000-word document, but it's put doping under the spotlight once again. It was only a few years ago that cyclist Lance Armstrong was banned from the sport for using performance-enhancing drugs throughout his career. His was one of the highest-profile cases ever detected. Others, perhaps, go unnoticed. So this week, we're going to dive into the world of steroids, stimulants and supplements as we ask, how easy is it to dope in sport?
Part 1. How to cheat.
Oh, I've received postcards and anonymous messages. You can't catch me.
If catching sports dopers is a game of cat and mouse, Michelle Verroken is one of the most experienced cats around. She was once an international korfball player. It's a more tactical version of netball, skills that stood her in good stead when she became head of Britain's anti-doping organisation. She did the job for 20 years.
I oversaw the introduction of the very first quality-assured anti-doping programme in the world, and then the introduction of the World Anti-Doping Code.
She now runs a consultancy, Sporting Integrity. She's helped to develop anti-drug procedures at most major sporting events in the country and flies around the world advising governments on how to catch sports cheats.
My next event is going to be the Commonwealth Youth Games in Samoa, where we've got an anti-doping programme running for the young people who are taking part.
So what exactly is doping in sport? Well, the first thing to say is that it's nothing new. In 1904, Thomas Hicks, an American athlete, won the Olympic marathon with the help of strychnine, raw egg and brandy, administered on the sidelines of the race. Doping has got more subtle since then, and more deadly.
There have been some very significant turning points. If we think way back, the death of cyclists like Tommy Simpson or Nud Jensen, these were cyclists who, as a consequence of their drug use, died during events, one during the Olympic Games, another during the Tour de France. The next turning point, I think, for everybody would have been the 100-metre final in Seoul.
Good afternoon. The world's fastest athlete has been stripped of his Olympic gold medal for taking drugs. Ben Johnson flies home in disgrace...
Since then, those fighting against the use of drugs in sport have sharpened up their game. In 1999, the World Anti-Doping Agency was created. They're responsible for updating and publishing a list of banned substances every year.
There are stimulants which increase the awareness, alertness, reaction time of the body, narcotics, the pain relievers. We have the hormone substances from the synthetic anabolic steroids right through to ways to increase the body's own testosterone level or even the body's own red blood cell count to offset the fatigue, so you're recovering more quickly in order to train again earlier.
As well as banning substances, there are prohibited methods of doping too, such as
taking out a quantity of your own blood and reinfusing the red blood cells to get the benefits. We've also known athletes try to have a kind of training buddy who's got a same blood group so that they could actually use their blood as well.
So that's how you dope. Next question, how do you get away with it?
At the moment, we have the elite level of athletes signed into a programme called Whereabouts. They must give one specific hour where they definitely could be found if the anti-doping authorities come to look for them.
And that's 7 days a week?
7 days a week, 52 weeks of the year. So it is still a cat-and-mouse game that we're playing.
And the mice have a lot of tricks, such as being somewhere else when the testers come knocking, or making sure their voicemail is full so they can't leave a message, or giving samples at a time of day when the drugs don't show up in their urine. Then there are the more imaginative tactics.
We do know that you can buy across the internet a prosthetic penis in order to provide a fake urine sample. But that's why we've
had... How does that... Sorry, talk me through that.
Well, the testing process has had to involve the observation of athletes providing that sample because of the manipulation techniques that have gone on.
So you would hide someone else's urine inside a prosthetic penis and then give the testers that sample?
That's right.
So, how easy is it to dope in sport? Well, getting hold of the drugs in the first place is relatively simple. Avoiding the testing is more difficult, but still doable. But that's only the first half of the game. The mice can't hide from the cats forever. At some point, sports dopers have to give a urine sample. And when that sample arrives at the lab, a new game of cat and mouse begins.
Part 2. How to catch a cheat.
My name is Professor David Cowan. I'm from King's College in London, and I'm the director of the Drug Control Centre.
Like our first expert witness, Professor Cowan spends a lot of time on the road. He's been advising officials in Japan, Brazil and South Korea on how to catch dopers in their upcoming Olympics, sharing what he learned as head of the drugs testing lab at London 2012.
During the Games, I was responsible for some 400 people, and turnaround time was much more rapid. Typically 10 working days. During the Olympics, it had to be one working day.
In 2 weeks, they tested over 6,000 samples, almost as many as his lab tests in a year. And he relished the challenge. He may be a scientist, but like a sportsman, he loves to win. Are you any good at sport? You've got an athlete's physique.
What a question. Yes, I'm small. I'm fairly fit. So am I competitive? Yeah, of course I am.
Competitive and confident. He says the scientific methods now available to his team of testers enable them to detect most banned substances.
We have analytical methods that are second to none. So we can find drugs in a sample very easily, provided we've got a reliable sample from the individual and the sample's taken at the right time.
To do this successfully, he has to meet two major challenges. First, making sure the test isn't too sensitive.
How do we know that what we found didn't get into your body just by you holding a handrail on a bus and then touching your mouth with your hand, or this may be a minor contaminant in a food.
And challenge two?
Proving the administration of something that the body produces naturally. In its simplest form, we all produce testosterone. How do we know someone hasn't injected some testosterone, as distinct from just being a person who produces large amounts?
Recent scientific advances mean they're getting better at differentiating those hormones that are artificially added to the body from those that are naturally produced. But these are just the challenges that arise when you know what you're looking for. How do you test for the newest drugs on the market? The ones you don't even know exist. The unknown unknowns.
What we do when we analyse a sample is to run it through a technique called chromatography. I think many of us had learnt at school that if we get a stain on some clothing, it often spreads out, and sometimes we even see a separation of colours. That's the technique of chromatography. A more sophisticated form of that is called high-performance liquid chromatography. Same principle applies, that we put the sample into an area and it will then separate it out in space.
So if the urine sample is, say, made up of 10 components, this process would separate them out. The next instrument, the mass spectrometer, then works out the mass of the material.
we can actually work out how many carbons there are in the molecule, how many hydrogens, how many oxygens, how many nitrogens, and from that start to build up the complete structure.
So you can break it down. Nothing could ever be invented that your testing wouldn't somehow identify.
The great majority of substances will certainly fit within our character.
Majority. So
the
they
great
could
majority.
Be.
Well, you know, never say never to a scientist, because a good scientist will always allow that remote possibility.
But as the dopers get more sophisticated, aren't you always going to be one step behind?
I question whether that is the case. I think it's fairly level in what's going on at the moment. Pharmaceutical companies are actually informing World Anti-Doping Agency of drugs in their pipeline. That is, we are getting informed long before it can get into the hands of the cheaters.
Surely the big problem in this is that it's very hard to know just how well scientists are doing, because the whole point about doping in sports is that if the athletes are doing it successfully, you won't know about it.
How do we know whether we're working or not? The cheating athlete keeps cheating. We catch up with them in the end.
The dopers might be getting more sophisticated, but so too are the scientific methods used to catch them, he says. They are keeping up. And when the anti-doping agencies find the sport dopers, this is what it sounds like.
Part 3. The cheat.
There were 26 agents that came crashing through the front door. They had a helicopter, and they had flak jackets. They had assault rifles. They were screaming. It was a very scary experience to be staring at all those gun barrels.
Meet Victor Conte, bass guitarist, self-taught chemist, and supplier of banned substances to athletes. His story begins in 1984. The man, once known as the walking fish, for being so laid back, had had enough of life as a session musician on the road. He wanted a new career, so he founded a sports supplement lab in California called Balco.
We did blood testing to develop individualized nutrition programs for elite athletes, and for 16 years I worked with a number of world-class athletes, and it had nothing to do with illegal performance-enhancing drugs.
In 2000, that changed.
I had been standing on the sidelines for a number of years, knowing what these athletes were doing, and had not joined the culture at that point. But once I realized that pretty much everybody was in on it, I made that decision to join the culture.
He started with a steroid called the Clear, so called because it was thought to be undetectable. As a new steroid, unavailable commercially, anti-doping agencies weren't on the lookout for it.
I got this substance from an organic chemist, and we didn't really know what it was, and so I took it myself. It was an oral substance that you put under your tongue with a dropper.
So you were your own guinea pig?
I was the initial guinea pig, yes. I took it myself for 4 consecutive days in a row, and then I began giving it to a variety of track and field athletes and football players and others.
What was the effect of the Clear when you gave it to athletes? What effect did it have on their performance?
Well, it enhanced recovery. Anabolic steroids are recovery drugs. What they enable you to do is train very strenuously, which creates micro tears and cuts in the muscle tissue, and then you bathe this in nitrogen that comes from the steroid, and it accelerates repair. So it enables you to get back to training again, where it would maybe take you 2 to 3 days to recover, you can recover in a day.
He supplied other performance-enhancing drugs too. Fast-acting insulin, growth hormones, thyroid medication, giving them to over 20 athletes. The results were immediate.
Kelly White had come out of college. She was a sprinter. And before using the Clear and other performance-enhancing substances, she had a personal best in the 100 meters of 11:19. Then after using a variety of drugs, in 2003, she ran 10:85. So yes, there's very, very powerful effects.
In 2002, he met Dwayne Chambers, the British track sprinter who'd just become the youngest ever medalist in the World Athletics Championships.
I met Dwayne Chambers at the University of Miami, and Dwayne was sitting on the grass there by the track putting his shoes on. So I had a little chat with him and told him the ABCs of what goes on at the elite level of sprinting. And the choice was made for him to try this.
That year, with the help of Victor Conte's drugs, Dwayne Chambers won the 100 metres at the European Championships in Munich. He was now the second fastest British sprinter of all time. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to him and Victor, the authorities were closing in.
They had my laboratory under surveillance for about a year, and of course they were dumpster diving, collecting information out of our trash, and they raided my laboratory and my home on that infamous September 3rd, 2003 day.
Victor Conte was jailed for 4 months. Soon after, one of Dwayne Chambers' samples was retested and found positive for banned substances.
Dwayne Chambers has been banned from competition for 2 years by the sports governing body, UK Athletics. Chambers was found guilty of using a banned steroid, THC.
When Victor Conte left prison, he wrote a detailed letter explaining exactly what he'd been giving to Dwayne Chambers. The steroid called the Clear on a Monday and Wednesday, testosterone cream on a Tuesday and Thursday, and a hormone called EPO on Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. He also revealed how sports dopers avoided getting caught.
If they're going to use a fast-acting testosterone, a gel, a cream, they do it at night. One study showed you could take 40 milligrams of oral testosterone, and then it will peak in your bloodstream and then go back down within 6 hours. So they're using these drugs at night, and by the time the testers show up in the morning, they test negative.
How easy, then, do you think it is to dope in sport now?
I think it's very easy. I do. I think there's all sorts of things that athletes can do and circumvent, and there's nothing they can do about it.
He accepts that testing is becoming more sophisticated, but says there are always new, undetectable drugs being developed. In that case, do we need to look at it from a different angle? Instead of asking how easy it is to cheat, perhaps we should ask, how difficult is it not to?
Part 4. Why cheat?
I think where I became aware of it first of all was through Ben Johnson. That was, for me, the first time I really kind of stood up and took note of it as an issue. At the time, I was a discus thrower.
This is Sue Backhouse, a talented athlete who made it all the way to national competitions. But a sporting career was not for her. She decided to become an academic instead. She's now professor of psychology at Leeds Beckett University. She and her team have spent 10 years researching what leads athletes to dope.
We've done surveys with athletes at all levels, coaches, other athlete support personnel, sport and exercise scientists, medical professionals.
They found that there are key moments in an athlete's career when they'll be tempted to dope.
Their willingness to dope appears to follow periods of instability, where it might be following an injury, it could be where they are in a career transition, or if funding is at risk.
They're all moments of vulnerability in the fragile life of a top athlete. Picked out at a young age, funneled into a grueling training regime, isolated from their wider networks of friends, giving up everything in the pursuit of one thing, winning. It gives those closest to them a lot of power.
The athlete support network is based on a lot of trust, particularly between the athlete and the coach. And in addition to maybe explicitly encouraging or facilitating doping, we have in the past had cases where coaches have actually deceived sports people into doping.
Of course, it's about money too. In some countries, like the UK, athletes only get funding if they remain at a high standard.
The rewards of success are very tangible. You know, there's clear links to those who are succeeding in the Olympics and medaling. And then from that, the sponsorship that flows their way, etc. There's also the element in the professional sports of contracts and remaining on contracts.
You have gone on to have a very successful career in research and psychology. Do you think one of the problems is that a lot of sports people don't have an alternative career? So the stakes are so high and that leads them to dope.
Yeah, and actually, research that we've undertaken highlights the importance of fostering a dual career approach. The willingness to dope is potentially much greater in those who have got a very singular identity as an athlete.
But there's another pressure, a more pervasive one. And that's the pressure that stems from the general perception that everyone's doping. You can't win without cheating. Or, as the saying goes, no dope, no hope.
There's definitely a relationship between the perception of use and then an individual's willingness to use. So what we do need to do is look to highlight the fact that not everyone is doping, particularly when we're talking to young athletes.
But how do you persuade athletes that not everyone's doping? Because no one knows just how many sports dopers there are. Only 1 to 2% of drugs tests come back positive every year. Does that mean only a minority are doping? Or does this mean the cats aren't catching the mice?
That's the challenge, I think. You know, when we've got the media headlines, which are, you know, are fairly frequent in the context of drugs in sport, that does lead to the perception that it's really widespread. But quite simply, at this moment in time, we've got no way of knowing how widespread it is.
That's why former head of anti-doping in the UK, Michelle Verroken, says the testing regime needs to change.
I think the way we craft the rules turns the system into something of a game. We should be putting the onus back on athletes. Athletes, you're the ones who are going to be able to demonstrate that you are participating cleanly.
Former drug distributor Victor Conte agrees.
I work with quite a few professional boxers, and I've gotten some of them to enroll in testing 24/7, 365. They want their fans to know that they are a clean athlete. At the end of the day, people want to know that the competition they're seeing is based upon hard work and that it's not because they've got the smartest chemist.
Of course, sports dopers could still find loopholes in a daily voluntary testing system, but the broader point is this. The current game of cat and mouse doesn't give sportsmen and women the certainty that they're competing on a level playing field. So how easy is it to dope in sport and get away with it? Ultimately, no one really knows. For now, the dopers and the scientists appear to be neck and neck. Both are getting more sophisticated. But if the dopers one day start to pull ahead, will we ever know?
This inquiry was presented by Helena Merriman and produced by Simon Maben and Wesley Stevenson in London. You can find more of our programs at our website. And if you've got a burning question you'd like us to answer, demand an inquiry on the World Service Facebook page or get in touch on Twitter at BBC The Inquiry.